Sounds True presents Robert Anton Wilson Explains Everything, or Old Bob Exposes His Ignorance, Session 2, General Semantics, Language, Literature, and Reality.
Bob, one of the consistent themes in almost everything you've written is about the use of language, particularly in the sense of general semantics. What is it about this that intrigues you so much?
Well, first I got interested in general semantics, then I got interested in some related fields like metalinguistics. General semantics took Korzybski 900 pages, including a lot of mathematics, to explain what it's all about. Lots of people have written popularizations to make it simpler. I would say part of what it's about, instead of saying what general semantics is all about, part of what it's about is the way the words we use influence our perceptions and therefore our behavior. And metalinguistics, which was founded by Benjamin Lee Whorf, is the science of how different languages create different worldviews. He was an expert in American Indian languages, and one of his most memorable essays was a demonstration that it's easier to discuss Einstein's relativity in Hopi than it is in English. One of Whorf's sentences that I underlined about 30 years ago or 40 was, a change in language can transform our apprehension of the cosmos. And you can't see that very strongly in the Indo-European group because they all have basically the same structure. But if you learn enough mathematics, you begin to think in a different way than Indo-European. And I was fortunate enough to encounter Ezra Pound and Ernest Fenollosa very early on. Pound thought Victorian poetry was a lot of slush and it had lost the qualities of true poetry. He established two rules for modern poetry. Don't use abstractions. If you want to deal with abstractions, write a philosophical essay, but don't try to pass them. And the second rule is, after you get rid of all the abstractions, make the imagery as precise, definite as possible. And that was the beginning of the Imagist movement. And writing according to his own rules, Pound attracted the attention of the widow of Ernest Fenollosa. Fenollosa was a Harvard graduate who went to Japan and fell in love with Oriental poetry and Oriental painting. And he wrote several books trying to explain Oriental painting and poetry to Westerners. Before Fenollosa, there was a general impression among Western scholars that Chinese and Japanese poetry was primitive and crude. And Fenollosa argued that it was neither primitive nor crude, but very highly sophisticated. And that's why there are haiku all around these days, including computer haiku and movie review haiku and so on. It was Fenollosa who started the whole interest in brevity and precision of imagery in Oriental poetry, especially the haiku form, but in Chinese poetry generally, even in longer verse forms than the haiku. The whole emphasis is on the specificity and brilliance of the imagery, clarity of imagery. And Pound was writing in that style. Mrs. Fenollosa was looking for somebody to complete her husband's translation of a batch of Chinese poems. She read Pound. She decided he was the one. She turned her husband's notebooks over to him. And Pound thereafter embarked on a 40-year campaign of learning the Chinese language and translating most of the Chinese classics. And this led him to give up the term imagism and describe what he was doing is ideogrammic method. Chinese ideograms are not all made up of pictograms, but a certain percentage of them are. Well, Fenollosa had studied with Emerson, and Emerson was the one who said, every word is a fossilized poem. That's much clearer in Chinese than it is in Indo-European. You look at the word for intelligence, for instance, and it's the sun and moon together.
In Chinese characters.
In Chinese characters. The sun and moon together, so intelligence and brightness are related. My God, we got that in English too. We say the student is bright when we mean the student is intelligent. It's more clear in the Chinese when you look at the sun and moon together. It's two kinds of light, which I think correspond to the right and left spheres of our brain. Or you take the Tao, which so many people have offered so many different translations of. You look at the ideogram, and it's a sign for intelligence together with a sign for movement. So the basic idea of the Tao is an intelligent movement. Take the Tao Te Ching. My Chinese pronunciation is abominable. It's even worse than my French. But I'm going to make a fool of myself and attempt it because I can't write the ideograms in the air. Ren Fa Di, Di Fa Tian, Tian Fa Dao, Tao Fa Tsu Ran. Now, to take that literally, word for word, remember every word in Chinese is both a noun and a verb and an adverb and an adjective, depending on where it goes. It doesn't have the subject-predicate structure. But word for word, it's man, model, earth, earth, model, universe, universe, model, Tao, Tao, model, self, such. And this is an entirely different way of thinking than you think in Indo-European. I'm not trying to pass myself off as a Chinese scholar or anything like that, but the little bit of Chinese I picked up through Fanalosa and Pound and Alan Watts, who usually has the Chinese ideograms for the key terms, at least in some of his books, and Needham, Science and Civilization in China, in which he has all the scientific terms and philosophical terms from ancient China up through the revolution. China was ahead of the West in science up until the 17th century, and then something happened and the West got ahead. The little I know of math, the little I know of Chinese, and what I've read about American Indian languages by Benjamin Lee Whorf, well, reinforced Kozhibsky's original impression upon me that if you use words in a particular way, it will influence the way you perceive the world. It will even influence the way you behave.
When did Kozhibsky's main book come out?
Well, his first book came out in 1919. It was called Manhood of Humanity, and it was based on the theory of time binding, how signals passed across generations tend to accumulate faster and faster. It was about the information explosion, except that word hadn't been coined yet, so he called it time binding. His major work, Science and Sanity, came out in 1933.
And was this widely accepted?
It got a lot of enthusiastic reviews from a lot of distinguished people, and it had a tremendous impact on all of the social sciences for a while. Among the people who praised it, the anthropologist Malinowski, Bertrand Russell, the mathematician, Loeb, the biologist, oh, quite a few, Poincaré, the mathematician, Bridgman, the physicist, a very distinguished list. But then Martin Gardner in the 1940s wrote a book called Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science, in which he denounced general semantics as quackery. And general semantics still exists. It's taught in lots of colleges. It still is a major influence on the social sciences, but it's not quite as reputable as it was in the 30s.
Didn't he have quite an influence on the beat movement as well?
Well, he had a big influence on William Burroughs. Burroughs studied with Kozhibsky personally. I studied with Kozhibsky's successors at the Institute of General Semantics, but Burroughs studied with Kozhibsky himself. Wow. Burroughs and I, really, that was one of the things we had in common, is that interest in how words influence perceptions. That's what led Burroughs to his experiments with cut-ups. If you break the lines of word and image, what happens? Do you get free of the patterns in there? Do you create new patterns? Or are you still stuck with the same old patterns because you're using the same words? I think all of Burroughs' cut-up experiments are interesting. My favorite is in a book called The Third Mind, and it goes, God damn floating whorehouse, death is the navigator. I have no idea what he cut up to produce those memorable lines, but I think that's among the greatest poetry of the 20th century. He may have cut up a porno novel and a news story, or a porno novel and a poem by Dylan Thomas. Burroughs cut up all sorts of things. Burroughs did a short article in one of his books made up of cut-ups of the most devastating critiques written of his works by critics who didn't like his works. He cut them all up and made a word salad out of them. And he says, I think this is one of the most remarkable pieces of prose I have ever produced, and I say so without any vanity at all because I didn't contribute a single word. I just did the arrangement. I did the same thing, by the way, in a minor way. And the Earth Will Shake, the comments, when Sigismundo does his first public performance on the harpsichord.
Yeah, and no one can stand it.
Well, some of the audience likes it. Most of them can't stand it. All the critical comments are taken out of negative reviews of my own books. Only I cut them up a little and rearranged them so it could apply to music instead of books. I mean, you got to do something with negative criticism. You can either brood about it and get morbid or try to forget it, or you can make a joke out of it. Joyce, I think, was the first one to realize the value of making a joke out of it. The seventh chapter of Finnegan's Wake, the Shem the Penman chapter, consists, oh, maybe as much as 70% of lines taken from negative reviews of Ulysses.
What did he feel was the value of using them?
As Norman Mailer would say, it was one way of saying fuck you to the reviewers. We all love our own works. Confucius said we naturally love what we see growing up in our own household, talking about parental love. Well, writers feel that way about their books. Our books are like our children. Anybody who attacks our books, it's like they're attacking our children. We're hurt, we're angry, and if you show it, you're acting infantile. So they have a variety of choices. John Steinbeck was notorious for writing nasty letters to unfavorable reviewers. Joyce never replied to any of his reviewers, no matter how nasty they were. He just saved all of them and turned them into high comedy in Finnegan's Wake. I think that's the most constructive use of them. One of the most negative reviews I ever got is on my website. When you click on excerpts from my books, before you get the excerpts, you get this denunciation of me by Robert Schaefer from the Skeptical Inquirer. Quote goes, Wilson describes himself as a guerrilla ontologist, signifying his intent to attack thought and language the way terrorists attack their targets, to leap from the dark for an unprovoked attack and then slink back to hide behind a hearty belly laugh. The unprovoked attack, I especially love. Why unprovoked? Why does he think I wasn't provoked? The reason is because he thinks entirely in cliches. An unprovoked attack is one of those cliches that you hear all the time. You know, if he stopped to think, he'd realize I was very provoked. How about Nietzsche and Wittgenstein? Were their attacks on thought and language provoked or unprovoked?
Well, what would he say?
I don't know what he'd say.
So how much truth is there in his review? Are you seeking to make an attack on people's thought and language?
I don't regard it as an attack. I regard it as an effort at liberating them from their chains.
So rather than a terrorist, as he styles you, you're a freedom fighter.
Well, that's the way I see it, but I can see why he sees me as a terrorist. All dogmatists see me as a terrorist, whether they're fundamentalist materialists like Schaefer or fundamentalist Christians like Jerry Falwell. They all recognize that my zetetic or agnostic position is a profound threat, because more and more of modern science, not only the physical sciences but the social sciences and modern philosophy in general, more and more are recognizing that if they're not as radical as some of my statements, they all recognize there's a degree of uncertainty in all observation. And if there's a degree of uncertainty in observation, then there's a degree of uncertainty in our inferences that we make from observation. And so anybody who claims to have the complete truth about everything is deliberately contradicting most of the knowledge of the 20th century.
Now, has Korzybski's work interwoven well with scientific discoveries in other fields?
Yeah, I feel that. I just reread Science and Sanity about a year ago for the first time in about 30 years. I read it about 10 or 15 times when I was in my 20s. Then I felt I had digested it well enough I didn't have to go on rereading it. But a year ago, I reread it again, and I was astounded at nothing Korzybski said in 1933 really needs to be seriously revised in the light of future science. As a matter of fact, most of it makes more sense than it did when he wrote it. The general idea of the organism as a whole and the environment as a whole, they may not use that word, but that appears more and more in all the behavioral and social sciences, including ethology and animal psychology and so on. And his whole emphasis on space-time rather than space and time, which he took from Einstein, that I think is getting more and more generally recognized, that we've got to think in four-dimensional rather than three-dimensional terms. Which, you know, that's what underlies that quote from Bucky Fuller I'm so fond of. universe is non-simultaneously apprehended.
Meaning we can never see the whole universe at once?
Yeah, the whole universe at once is a meaningless expression within special and general relativity. All we can say is this part of the universe within the same inertial system we're in.
So maybe the world is starting to become a place more friendly to general semantics.
Every time I read a book on behavioral science, I see some influence of general semantics. I don't think they've all read Koszybski, but they've all read people who've been influenced by Koszybski. For instance, Gestalt therapy. One of the founders of Gestalt therapy, Frederick Perls, was very heavily influenced by Koszybski, as well as by Wilhelm Reich, by the way. And I think ethnomethodology, Garfinkel never mentions Koszybski, but I don't think Garfinkel could have thought of half of his experiments if he hadn't either read Koszybski or somebody who read Koszybski.
So for the benefit of those who don't know much about Koszybski or general semantics, what are the basic ideas that he put forth?
Well, as I say, it took him 900 pages, including a lot of mathematics, so everything I say must be taken as an oversimplification. Three of the major principles he puts in terms of the map territory metaphor. The first is the map is not the territory. And at a crude level, if you're dehydrated and about to die of dehydration, no matter how many times I say water, 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 you're still going to go on being thirsty. The word is not the thing. The map is not the territory. Labels, especially pejorative labels. If you keep referring to somebody by a pejorative label, you more and more treat that person as if they were the label. Or you go into a building and they tell you this is the sacristy, so you're not supposed to raise your voice. The word has created a magic aura. It's just like any other building. You walk into another place and you don't know whether it's a junkyard or an art gallery. And when somebody tells you this is an art gallery, oh, then you look at everything as a work of art. If they told you it was a junkyard, you look at everything as a piece of scrap metal.
So the labels that we give objects strongly influence our perception of the object.
Yeah. That's why people who keep saying nigger are not going to listen very closely to any argument for racial equality. The word itself hypnotizes them into dividing the human race into two parts, the real humans and the ones that are only partly human. And that's the way they perceive the world, and that word helps perpetuate that type of perception. The same with all racial epithets.
But as long as we're going to use words to describe things, how can we help but use maps to describe the territory?
Well, we got to use maps. Koszybski's point is we got to realize the map is not the territory. And the second point is the map does not show all the territory. And my favorite illustration of that is a map of Dublin, Ireland, that showed all the territory. It would have to be at least 2,000 years old, because we know there were people settled around there at least 2,000 years ago. It would have to be 2,000 years old, perpetually changing over the 2,000 years, and including God knows how many million human beings, how many hundred million rats and mice, how many billions of bacteria, how many deer, bear, and other critters that have been driven out by now, all of them moving for 2,000 years. That would be a complete map, and it would be no use whatsoever, because the purpose of a map is to simplify it. Help you understand. When you include everything you haven't simplified and you don't understand any better, all you got is a vast whirling confusion. So the map does not show all the territory, which means no model covers the whole universe. No theory explains everything. And the third, which is the most subtle, is you can make a map of the map and a map of the map of the map and so on to infinity. Which means that as information accumulates, every map can be revised, and you can make a map of the map. As, for example, chemistry and physics were two different sciences up until physical chemistry began to appear. Neurology and psychology are more and more being replaced by neuropsychology or psychoneurology. Immunology has blended with two other sciences, and now you see there's actually a journal, I think, called the Journal of Psychoneuroimmunology, which is brain, nervous system, immunological system interactions, which is, I think, where you find the whole explanation of faith healing, Christian Science, spontaneous remission, and other medical oddities of that sort, where what people think seems to have an effect on how fast they recover or how well they recover from an illness. And now we've got sciences like ethnomethodology, which is sort of the social science that studies other social sciences. That's definitely a map of the map. And in a sense, Marxism is a map of all previous economics. Marxism analyzes how all previous systems of economics rationalized the interests of some class or other. And Marxism is more true than the others, according to the Marxists, because it rationalizes the class interest of the class that is going to take over the whole world eventually, namely the suffering and crucified workers. It's a variation on the basic Christian myth put into sociological jargon. Freudianism is a map of all previous maps, in the sense you can use Freud to analyze anybody's maps and see what neurotic functions they are serving, what self-defensive. For instance, a Freudian analysis of Marxism would say that Marx must have had a lot of conflicts with his father, which he projected onto the capitalist as a father figure, and the whole Marxist movement is an Oedipal rebellion of sons against fathers, which oddly enough was suggested by Guillaume Baptista Vico in 1735, long before Freud or Marx. Vico said all revolutions are sons against fathers. That's in his book, The New Science, which is the basic structure that Joyce adopted in Finnegan's Wake.
Isn't Vico one of the background characters for Finnegan's Wake?
Yeah, he plays as an important a role in Finnegan's Wake as Homer does in Ulysses. Vico is sometimes called a philosopher, but I have seen him referred to as the father of scientific sociology. He thought he was a scientist. His book is called The New Science, and it's an attempt to analyze history in a way that makes sense out of it. He was one of the first to realize the importance of language in creating perception. He came 200 years before Kozybski or Benjamin Lee Whorf or Edward Sapir. By the way, the theory that language influences perception is nowadays generally called the Kozybski-Whorf-Sapir hypothesis, because all three of them published it at approximately the same time. I tend to quote Kozybski more often than Whorf or Sapir, because Kozybski, I think, made a more totally revolutionary system out of that simple basic discovery. And he offered a whole bunch of clues as to how you could reform your language to avoid most of the errors that seem to be built into the Indo-European subject-predicate language structure.
So he not only pointed out a problem, but a solution.
He saw a problem and a bunch of tools to help you work toward a solution.
What would some of those be?
Well, I've been doing it throughout all these programs, and nobody can see it because these are audios. It's the gesture of waving two fingers in the air. It's putting quotes around a word. That is to remind yourself and remind the people you're talking to that that word has multiple meanings, and there's no general agreement, and it hasn't been scientifically and operationally defined, so we may be blundering into metaphysics without even knowing that we're doing so. He put those quotes around all sorts of words, like mind, and whenever he had to refer to space, he'd put quotes around it. He wouldn't put quotes around space-time because he thought that had been scientifically defined. But if he had to refer to space alone, he'd put quotes around it. And God, he not only put quotes around it, but when he was talking, he spoke the letters out loud, quote, G-O-D, unquote. He felt that was such a dangerous and unscientific term that you had to protect yourself doubly against falling into traps when you started using it. Another of Kozybski's devices is dating. Like, John is grouchy, which is a sentence you might hear any day, anywhere. It carries over the medieval scholastic version of Aristotelianism implicitly, which assumes that John has some kind of demon or essence or metaphysical something inside him called grouchiness. A more operational statement, which Kozybski would prefer, were John seemed grouchy at the office this morning. Now, if you believe John is grouchy is a sensible sentence, and you meet John at the beach, he's got a beer can in his hand and his arm around a beautiful girl, and he's laughing his head off, then you got to conclude John has multiple personality disorder. John is grouchy and John is cheerful. Oh, he's bipolar personality. But if you realize the organism and the environment principle, John may very well be grouchy in the office because it's a miserable place to work. And John may be basically a cheerful person when he's not stuck in the office.
Isn't that the kind of ambiguity that we just learn to deal with?
Well, the thing is, Kozyupski's tactics are to help you deal with it and be on guard against these kind of overstatements. As a fascinating example, fascinating to me anyway, the hero of Joyce's Ulysses, Leopold Bloom. Critics refer to Bloom as a Jew from the 1920s up until the 1970s when somebody published an essay in the James Joyce Review called, "Is Leopold Bloom a Jew?" It depends on how you define Jew. According to the rabbinical definition, a Jew is the son of a Jewish mother. Bloom is not Jewish by that definition. He's the son of a Protestant mother. According to the Nazi definition, a Jew is anybody with a known Jewish ancestor. Bloom is a Jew by that definition because his father was Jewish. A third definition is a Jew is somebody who practices the Jewish religion. By that definition, almost every Jew I know is not a Jew. I don't know a single Jew who practices the religion. And Leopold Bloom doesn't practice the religion either, so he's not a Jew by that definition. The fourth definition is somebody who, even though he doesn't practice the religion and doesn't have a Jewish mother, regards himself as Jewish because of ethnic or cultural solidarity. And then there's a fifth category, which is somebody who doesn't generally think of himself as Jewish, but suddenly finds himself identified that way or identifying himself that way, like Dreyfus, perhaps, when he denounced some of Israel's foreign policies. I don't think he generally thinks of himself as Jewish, but he had to think of himself as Jewish when he was criticizing Israel. How is Leopold Bloom a Jew? The answer turns out by three definitions he isn't, and by two definitions he is. And is this trivial? I don't think so. I think Joyce made Bloom's background genetically and culturally so complicated to make anti-Semitism seem even more ridiculous. Because Bloom is only Jewish by some definitions. Yet the anti-Semites that Bloom encounters during the long day of Ulysses, they all treat him as if they know what a Jew is and that Bloom fits their definition. Hardly any of them know he doesn't practice the Jewish religion, for instance. As a matter of fact, Bloom is officially a Catholic, although he doesn't practice that religion either, but he converted in order to marry Molly.
So you're saying that the words that we use are often reductive to the point of actually warping the situation?
Yeah, well, I think almost all forms of group prejudice, group bias, group hatred, group violence are all, I think they're all either caused by or vastly exacerbated by the use of labels with pejorative connotations.
So, how can we protect ourselves against this besides making quotes in the air and using time-based statements?
Well, using the Kozyupski system of indexing. Like, if you want to generalize about plumbers, the first thing you got to call to mind, according to Kozyupski, plumber sub 1 is not plumber sub 2, is not plumber sub 3, is not plumber sub 4. They're all different. They not only have different fingerprints, they have different degrees of competence in the science of plumbing. They have different degrees of honesty. You find lots of cases. Somebody's been cheated by a plumber and knows it. He's going around for the next 20 years telling everybody, you can't trust those goddamn plumbers, they're all a bunch of thieves. Which is the same logic as one of my first general semantics teachers, a psychologist named Ray Bontrager, pointed out that the classic of that line of thought is all Indians always walk Indian file. I know because the one I saw was walking that way.
So the basic idea is that, you know, in a sense, there are no classes.
Yes. That was a big debate in medieval theology between the nominalists and the realists. And my viewpoint definitely is descended from the nominalists. Classes exist in the human mind. We create classes in order to understand the universe. But everything in the universe is a unique and distinct individual space-time occurrence. I am not myself from one day to the next. An electron is not itself from one nanosecond to the next.
So how can we effectually speak about anything?
Well, I write books about all sorts of things. But the point is, you've got to follow certain rules if you want to attain maximum clarity. If you follow these rules, you may not attain maximum clarity, but you'll attain greater clarity than usual, and Robert Schaefer will denounce you as a terrorist launching an unprovoked attack on thought and language.
So what are some more of the rules? How can we make our language more accurate?
Well, an application of Kojipki that a lot of psychiatrists use, especially clinical psychologists, especially in rational emotional therapy, but it's infiltrated several other schools of therapy. Let's say you hate somebody who did some terrible wrong to you. Let's say, to take a very topical subject, you were the victim of incest. So you hate your father. The rational emotive therapy approach to that and the Kojipkian approach would be first to date and index it, because at this point, by the time you're an adult, you probably hate all fathers. So the first thing is, you don't know all fathers. How many fathers have you known? How many fathers do you know have committed incest? That's limited to the one who hurt you. Okay, you hate him. When do you hate him? Do you hate him when he did it, or do you still hate him now? And do you know if he's still committing incest, or has he been cured or something? The thing is to specify, isolate, and clarify what you hate. And then the thing is, what good does it do hating anyway? What are you going to do about it? You're going to make a decision rather than just going around hating all the time. You either bring him to trial, or you forgive him, possibly, I don't know. That's very unfashionable. That's an old-fashioned Buddhist idea, which is not in keeping with political correctness. I guess you should bring the bastard to trial. But whatever the case may be, the thing is to isolate it. Like, this is a wild guess, but I think Adolf Hitler, when he was trying to make a living as a painter, he lost a couple of good commissions to a Jewish painter. And I think Hitler decided the Jews are getting ahead because they're underhanded and tricky, because I know I'm a better painter than he was. Now, if he had dated in an index that he would say, this one guy sold a painting to a client I was helping to sell a painting to. Instead, he generalized about all the Jews in the whole goddamn world. How many of them had he ever actually met? Well, you know, everybody knows Hitler was crazy. But from the point of view of general semantics, he was talking about millions and millions of people he never met, never looked at, never shook hands with, never looked in the eye. And he thought he knew all about all these people. The only case I can think of equal insanity is some of the feminists who talk that way about all men when they've only known at most maybe 120 men out of the 2.5 billion on the earth right now.
It's certainly a higher number than the number of Jews. Yeah.
Yeah. So you might say the androphobes are even crazier than the anti-Semites, because they're generalizing about an even bigger group they know even less about.
Isn't this one of the facets of intelligence, though, is, and science even, is to be able to generalize about things so that we can fit our model to more than individual objects or situations?
Yeah, of course, but the thing is, we got to learn how to generalize scientifically rather than recklessly or unscientifically or superstitiously. It's like Mark Twain, in an argument with an anti-Semite, said anti-Semitism reminds me of a stupid cat I once owned that sat on a hot stove and never sat on a hot stove again. And the anti-Semite said, what's stupid about that? And Twain said, the cat never sat on a cold stove either. So you got to learn how to make generalizations, which involves dating and indexing. And another important part of general semantics comes out of operationalism in physics and is closely related to John Dewey's instrumentalism, which is, you should specify how you made the observation, which is part of the observation according to quantum mechanics. Like, the electron appears as a wave when observed with this set of apparatus. The electron appears as a particle when observed with this set of apparatus. You don't say the electron is a wave or the electron is a particle. You just say it appears as when observed with this kind of apparatus. And then you come to the things that people are in perpetual ideological furor about, like, is the fetus human or not? Well, according to operationalism, you can't even ask that question. According to the operationalist attitude of modern physics, the only question you can ask is, what benefits of clarity accrue from considering the fetus human? What benefits of clarity accrue from considering the fetus not yet the human?
So the idea is that there's no such thing as it being one or the other. It's just...
Here we come to the basic issue, the question of being. One of Koshybsky's most radical suggestions consisted of dropping the word is from the English language entirely. English without is, which is called E prime.
He named it E prime?
No, that was a name invented by David Borland, one of Koshybsky's students. I have written two books in E prime, maybe three, I'm not sure, two and a half. And one is an anthology. My contributions are all in E prime, but the other contributors wrote as they pleased. But I've written two books entirely in E prime, and I've written a lot of other things in E prime, including a couple of movie reviews. I'm surprised how well E prime serves writing movie reviews.
Can you give us a verbal example of how E prime would compare to a normal English sentence?
Garlic smells awful. That doesn't have the is of identity in it, but it's an absolutist statement. A more operational statement is garlic smells awful to me. Because there are some people who like the smell of garlic.
So you're being clear that it's your personal observation that you're...
Yeah, and like this is a point... Okay, well, let's not say this is. Let's take a title. Behind the Green Door is a pornographic movie. That's a statement in ordinary English. In E prime, it would come out, Behind the Green Door seems like a pornographic movie to me, which is, qualifies as a scientifically valid statement unless you're lying about it to prove it, to win an argument or some trick like that. But to say it is pornographic is to imply that there's an essence of pornography in it, like the essence of the Jesus Christ in the host when the cannibals have their feast every Sunday. There is no such thing as an essence of pornography, scientifically speaking, until somebody invents what I call a smutometer. And you point this at a movie or a book, and it tells you how many micro chambers or micro Lovelaces of smut it has in it. You get a direct. Until you have that kind of measurement, people are just talking about their own nervous systems and thinking they're talking about the external world.
But they're not making it clear because they're using this is in a special way.
They don't realize that when they say it is a pornographic movie, they're confusing their own evaluations with what's out there. All you can say about what's out there is that the best scientific model suggests it's photons bouncing off a cloth.
How far are we required to take this in order to get the kind of clarity we're looking for? I mean, for example, you used an example where you said, the photon appears as a wave when I measure it with a certain apparatus. But you could take it even further and say, the photon appeared as a wave when I measured it with what I thought was this apparatus.
You know,
and go into sort of an infinite regress.
Well, yeah, Schrödinger created what's called the Schrödinger's cat problem, which goes as follows. You take a cat, you put it in a box, you put a poison gas pellet in there, and you put a radioactive element which will emit a certain amount of radiation statistically over a certain period of time. Then you close the door. You sit down, you write the equations out and solve the equations for any given time, let's say 15 minutes. And you find you get a minimum of two solutions. Enough radiation has been discharged to blow up the poison gas pellet, and enough hasn't been discharged yet. You always get a minimum of two answers. So until you open the door, the poison gas pellet has and has not exploded, and the cat is and is not dead. Once you open the door, the state vector collapses, and the cat's either dead or alive. Now, Schrödinger invented that because, although he was one of the major creators of quantum mechanics, he was very uncomfortable with its philosophical implications. And he said, until we can answer that question, we don't know what the hell we're talking about in quantum mechanics at all. What, does it make sense to say the cat isn't dead or alive until we open the door? And if it doesn't, why do we use equations that imply that we can't say so until we do open the door? And since physicists have been arguing about that since 1935, when Schrödinger first published it in Der Naturwissenschaft, volume 3 in Zwanzig, it thrilled me when I found out what the number of the issue where he published that. They've been arguing about that ever since. Meanwhile, one of my books is called Schrödinger's Cat, one of the best popularizations of quantum mechanics by John Gribben, the physics editor of New Scientist, is called In Search of Schrödinger's Cat. It really does highlight the major problem in quantum mechanics. Meanwhile, Wigner made it even worse by pointing out that after you open the door, the state vector is only collapsed for you. For another physicist in the hall outside the laboratory, the state vector doesn't collapse until you open the door and say, dead cat, or cat's still alive. Or if you consider a physicist on a computer in London, I'm assuming we're doing the experiment here in California, the state vector doesn't collapse until the email signal arrives in London. So Wigner from this concludes that we can't separate the observer from the observation in any sense whatsoever, and every observer creates a separate universe or has to be considered as having created a separate universe, depending on which signals they have apprehended at this point, which makes sense in terms of Buckminster Fuller's definition of universe as none simultaneously apprehended.
So in a sense, each person is carrying around their own universe.
Yeah, in a very real sense. And to repeat myself, I have done experiments hundreds of times in which I have audiences try to describe the same thing, and they all perceive it differently. And I only have them describe the hall outside the seminar room or the sounds they hear during a quiet period. I have done experiments where after they listen to the sounds and they all discover they heard different sounds, I ask them, how long did that listening experiment last? And I get estimates running from 15 seconds to 4 minutes. So we create our own time, too, which is what William Burroughs discovered in Tangier. One day he got up, had some coffee, made a little breakfast, wrote a letter, went down to American Express, mailed it, stopped at a cafe, had coffee with a friend, came home, and it was late afternoon. And Burroughs said, where did the whole day go to? He decided the short time mob had moved in. The short time mob are extraterrestrial invaders who steal our time when we're not paying attention. If you're paying attention, they can't steal your time. But if you're not paying attention, they steal a few minutes here, a few seconds there, a half hour here, and pretty soon there's a whole day gone. You don't know what happened. The short time mob has stolen your time. So the cure is attention, which Aldous Huxley also agreed with in his novel, Ireland, the enlightened ruler of this utopian island, has released minor birds that fly all over the island and keep shouting, attention, 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 just so everybody doesn't lose their time and drift off.
I guess the essence of my question was, can't we get almost absurd with the level of indeterminacy we'd be putting into our language? How far do you feel we really need to adjust how we're speaking in order to bypass a lot of problems?
I discovered that when I talk about uncertainty, people assume that means total uncertainty, and you can't be sure of anything. That's because of the domination of Aristotelian either-or language, true or false. If a thing isn't true or false, then you're totally lost if you're stuck in the Aristotelian game rules. But we've got several logic based on probability theory, invented by a mathematician named Wolofsky in the 1920s. The guy who invented fuzzy logic in the 1970s, Zadoff, and von Neumann suggested without probabilities, he just suggested a three-valued logic, true, false, and maybe. I have my own adaptation of Koszybski's infinite-valued logic. Koszybski calls it infinite-valued because he meant you could extend it to as many decimal points as you needed to solve a given problem. Mm. So it depends on what you're dealing with. But 1 to 10 is a good enough scale, and oddly enough, Arthur Clarke came to this opinion about the same time as me. He had a show, maybe it's still on some channel I don't get. He had a show called Mysterious Universe, in which he dealt with fringe science, scientists who get results that are rejected by the majority of the scientific community? Are they all crackpots, or do some of them have something? And he never gave a yes or no answer on any of them. He'd give a probability from 1 to 10, just like I do. You're not stuck in a void. You can make pretty good estimates. I know the sun does not come up literally, but since I don't want to be too finicky, let's just say the sun is going to come up tomorrow morning as a statement. Actually, it means the earth is going to continue revolving in a way that the sun will appear to come up in the morning. But anyway, I would set the probability of that at around 9.999 at least. If you want to go to 10 decimal places, I'll add a few more nines on.
This concludes Side A. Please turn the tape over for Side B.